The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello and welcome to ILTV's Zion News on the Blaze Radio Network. Coming up in today's newscast, the IDF retaliates after Palestinians open fire on Israeli troops near the Gaza border. Prime Minister Netanyahu urges the EU to follow Trump's example on Iran's sanctions. And get ready because it looks like Gal Gadot will be playing an actual real-life Wonder Woman in a new Showtime miniseries. Moments ago, violence erupted along the Israel-Gaza border amidst rumors of a pending ceasefire deal that's now seeming far less and less likely. Palestinians near the border have opened fire on a group of IDF soldiers stationed in the region. In response, the IDF's tank unit has just shelled a Hamas military site within the strip. Two Hamas operatives are believed to have been killed at this time. An additional six Palestinians have been reported injured in this attack. This is, of course, just the latest exchange of blows in a long string of escalation along the border in recent months. Attacks like these, in combination with the flying of explosives-laced kites and balloons from Gaza into Israel, has pushed both sides to the brink of war. Now, Egypt has reportedly entered negotiations with Israel and Hamas to avoid such a scenario with a long-term ceasefire deal. That proposal has been discussed at length by Israel's security cabinet amidst reports that Hamas has already actually agreed to it. A long-term ceasefire is looking unlikely at this point, but a temporary calm, which would include the halting of these Palestinian arson attacks, may very well be within reach despite this latest violence. We'll just have to wait and see. An anonymous top-level intelligence official has just told the New York Times that Israel is behind a massive assassination operation in Syria. A few days ago, Aziz Asbar and his driver were killed in an apparent car bombing. Asbar is one of Syria's leading rocket scientists who worked on numerous projects with both Iranian and Hezbollah weapons teams. Israel, as per policy, has neither confirmed nor denied any role in this death, of course, though one minister has said that it's a, quote, good thing that he's dead.
The unnamed source in the New York Times' report alleges that Israel contacted his agency to inform them of the attack on Asbar. He, or she, goes on to explain that Asbar had been a primary target of the Mossad for several years now. Now, this wouldn't be much of a surprise, considering Asbar's role in developing chemical weapons for the Assad regime, his high-level security status with both Iran and Hezbollah, and his work on streamlining a new breed of precision-guided mid-range Tishrin rockets. Adding some credence to the idea that Israel may indeed be behind this hit, the base where Asbar reportedly worked is the same site that IDF airstrikes have allegedly struck at least twice this year. Israeli Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman, however, has downplayed the idea of Israel's role in the assassination, saying, quote, every day in the Middle East there are hundreds of explosions and settling of scores. Every time they try to place the blame on us, so we won't take this too seriously, end quote. Either way, it's clear that Israel is relieved to have this weapons chief out of commission. As Public Security and Strategic Affairs Minister Gilad Erdan points out, Asbar is the man responsible for placing some very lethal weapons in the hands of some very bad people.
Reports of growing anti-Semitism in the UK are unfortunately nothing new, and neither are the accusations that the problem may be systemic within the framework of the government. Just this week, the UK's Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn has twice apologized for insensitivity towards Jewish people from his own party. Several Labour MPs have already resigned, with some under investigation internally from speaking out against Corbyn. Some 60-odd rabbis in Britain have even co-authored a letter expressing their fear about anti-Semitism in the UK, and joining me now to discuss this and go deeper into it is Paul Gross, a senior fellow at the Menachem Begin Heritage Center. Paul, thank you so much for joining us. Hi.
Thank you.
So my first question before we get to Corbyn and everything, you know, you're originally from the UK, obviously. I know you don't live there any longer. You live in Jerusalem now. But does it feel to you like anything has changed in Britain on the ground, you know, as someone who used to live there personally? Maybe you go back and forth.
Yeah, I do visit. I would say that there have certainly been increased incidents of anti-Semitism in the UK, but really the atmosphere has changed completely as a result of what's happened in the Labour Party. This is the main opposition party, the party that could well be the next government of Britain. Jeremy Corbyn, the leader, could well be the next Prime Minister of Britain. And since he became leader about 3 years ago, there has been literally an epidemic of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. And the letter that you mentioned from around 60 rabbis is unprecedented. This has never happened, that Jewish communal leaders, especially rabbis who from across the streams, right, across the denominations, right, who rarely agree on too much, have agreed on this, that there is a major problem facing the Jewish community in Britain as a result of what's happening in the Labour Party.
Right. I mean, I take this, you know, what you say very seriously, because you, of course, worked at Israel's embassy to the UK for many years. You have quite an inside look. So would you say that feeling from above filters down into the people, into the streets? Does it really seem like it trickles down?
Yeah, the three major Jewish newspapers that are formerly competitors, mm-hmm, got together and ran a joint headline, the same headline, United We Stand, a couple of weeks ago. And they said in their joint editorial that the Jewish community faces, quote, an existential threat. Now, they're not talking about the murder of the Jewish community or anything as radical as that, but they mean that Jews will leave, that if Jeremy Corbyn becomes prime minister, there will be large numbers of Jews that will not feel that this is a country they can remain in. This is a man, Jeremy Corbyn, who prior to becoming leader of the Labour Party was a peripheral figure in the party, but someone with past associations with Hamas, with Hezbollah, sure, with supporting anti-Semites from the Middle East and local British anti-Semites.
Sure.
This is his record.
Sure. Well, you know, Corbyn and the Labour Party have also refused to adopt, you know, certain, let's say, the definition of anti-Semitism as offered by the Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. Their definition of anti-Semitism, I think we also learned just this week, in fact, that Corbyn lobbied to, or proposed even, just to have the holiday, that day, Holocaust Memorial Day, change the name to Genocide Memorial Day. How should we interpret this, and what does that mean to you?
Right, so things keep on coming out of the woodwork from Corbyn's past that he'd much rather be buried there. One is that he was lobbying for Holocaust Memorial Day to be renamed. Another came out just today, which was an interview that he gave with Press TV, which is Iran's English language propaganda channel, in which he accused the BBC of being, quote, biased towards saying that Israel has a right to exist. This is stuff that he doesn't want coming out now because it's pretty embarrassing.
Right. As
you mentioned, the definition of anti-Semitism has been adopted across the UK by institutions, government agencies. The
sure,
only
the whole world,
organization yeah. in Britain that has not adopted it in full is the Labour Party.
Yeah. Well, look, I wish I could say that this is a thing that we're not going to be talking about in the near future, but I'm sure we will be. Maybe we'll be talking to you again soon. Either way, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
With the first wave of U.S. sanctions on Iran officially now in full effect, Israeli leaders are hopeful that the pressure will either topple the regime or else deter them from their current war path. Prime Minister Netanyahu has hailed U.S. President Donald Trump for defying the rest of the world and reimposing those sanctions. For now, it remains to be seen if Europe, Russia, and China will be able to preserve the current nuclear deal with Iran, or if a major change is yet on the horizon.
אני מברך את הנשיא טראמפ ואת הממשל האמריקני על ההחלטה החשובה להטיל סנקציות על איראן. זה רגע חשוב לישראל, לארצות הברית, לאזור, לעולם כולו. והוא מסמל את הנחישות לבלום את התוקפנות האזורית של איראן וגם את התוכניות המתמשכות שלה להתחמש בנשק גרעיני. אני קורא למדינות אירופה שמדברות על עצירת איראן להצטרף למהלך הזה. הגיע הזמן להפסיק לדבר. הגיע הזמן לעשות, זה בדיוק מה שארצות הברית עושה, זה מה שאירופה צריכה לעשות.
Echoing the praises of the Prime Minister is Public Security Minister Gilad Erdan. According to him, the first wave of new American financial pressure stands a good shot of forcing Iran to renegotiate the terms of the JCPOA nuclear deal. Erdan has slammed the EU, which he describes as morally bankrupt, for defying sanctions in lieu of preserving the original terms of that deal. Iran now faces a difficult turning point. On one hand, the regime says that they would stay in the deal if Europe, China, and Russia can counter the financial pressure of Trump's new sanctions, but on the other hand, if the deal collapses, they've threatened to resume developing nuclear weapons almost immediately, a move that depends on whether or not the regime can even stand on its feet financially by that time, especially with internal dissent and protests growing daily. This may indeed be the very scenario Israel is hoping to see, but with Iran threatening to close the crucial Bab al-Mandab Strait, Israel could be looking at a $15 billion hit in trade as well if that happens. It remains to be seen if such a move would amount to a declaration of war.
The latest data suggests that nearly 3 million posts on social media have now been linked to fake Russian accounts with the intent of swaying the 2016 U.S. presidential election. But in a shocking development, tens of thousands of those posts were apparently attempts to influence Israel-U.S. relations. At least 21 different states in the United States were targeted with these posts prior to the 2016 election. At this time, U.S. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has already identified and indicted 13 Russian nationals with ties to this plot. ILTV's Aaron Porras has more on this unfolding story. And Aaron, before we dive into the intent here, can you trace back for us where these posts exactly come from?
So I'll try to put this together chronologically as best as I can.
Sure.
But to all of you watching, by the way, at home, you can look it up and read the full report for yourselves. It's entitled Troll Factories, the Internet Research Agency, and State-Sponsored Agenda Building. And it was compiled by Clemson University researchers Darren Linville and Patrick Warren. Now, I'll sum it up now. In February 2018, as you mentioned, the United States Justice Department indicted 13 Russian nationals for playing a central role in a Russian effort to sow discord into American politics and sway voter turnout in the 2016 election. The 13 individuals all worked for the IRA, or the Internet Research Agency, based in St. Petersburg, and allegedly at the behest of Russian President Putin. Now, the IRA's activities are well documented going back all the way to 2014, and basically the IRA is a troll farm. They produce nearly 2,900 fake accounts, which produce nearly 3 million posts on Twitter alone. These posts were confirmed as being connected to the IRA by Twitter, and thanks to the report, we now have a much better understanding of what they were trying to accomplish with these posts.
Okay, and what is that objective exactly? Because I think it's important to know, you know, especially given the threat of Russian interference in the upcoming midterm elections and maybe the future presidential elections, exactly how this works. So how did they sow that discord in a way that impacted an election?
All right, well, again, I encourage everyone to read the full report.
Sure.
It's not long, but it showed that five specific categories of IRA-associated handles were identified. Trolls on the right, trolls on the left, newsfeed trolls, fearmongers, and hashtag gamers.
Those are the names.
Those are the categories that they split it up into.
Got it.
Yeah, exactly. Further, with the exception of the fearmongers, troll types were consistent and did not switch around. Now, the right trolls, which made up over half of those studied, were unanimously in support of Trump following his nomination and continuously bombarded social media feeds with populist nationalist messages. They also wrote things likely to divide Republicans amongst themselves. Oddly enough, they did not express any of the traditional Republican views related to things like regulations, taxes, abortion, etc. Then about 25% of the trolls studied were left trolls, designed to focus heavily on identity and race politics and also division among the Democrats. Now, the newsfeed troll accounts typically just rerouted people to certain news stories that, surprise, surprise, were often pro-Russian. And then finally, you have the fearmongers and the hashtag gamers. The gamers, they just played popular hashtag word games, but sometimes painted the games with political undertones, like, you know, hashtag offend everyone in four words. Undocumented immigrants are illegals, right? Okay. The fearmongers, just as you probably guessed, just created drama and crisis wherever possible.
This web is so complex, but also detailed.
Yeah.
But look, all this makes sense when you talk about the 2016 U.S. election, at least that's what it seems like. But where exactly does Israel fit in? I mean, why would the Russians actually want to boost the prospect of an Israeli U.S. friendship?
So again, the aim of these posts was to create division in the U.S.
Okay.
Israel is seen as a divisive topic in the world right now. And so, you know, the same methods were employed. Posts mentioning Israel or Israeli politics heavily mirrored the same rhetoric used surrounding the U.S. election, being split roughly 60-40 between being pro-Netanyahu and against him, calling the media liars, sowing malcontent, etc. The report concludes by saying that what the IRA did isn't just political warfare, it's industrialized political warfare that needs to be heavily monitored and accounted for ahead of any future elections everywhere.
Industrialized being the key word there. Now, President Trump has declared the Russian investigation to be a complete witch hunt regardless. His own White House has confirmed as recently as yesterday that the threat of Russian interference is very real in upcoming elections. Thanks for giving us this detail, Aaron.
Thank you.
Now, the government's powerful Ministerial Committee for Legislation has just advanced a crucial new bill seeking to deter illegal prostitution, or more specifically, to deter people who solicit prostitutes. Now, the proposed legislation still needs to, of course, be passed through the normal channels of the Knesset in the next session to become a law. But if and when it does do that, the new legislation would punish Johns with fines, giving repeat offenders as much as 75,000 shekels worth of fees.
This proposal comes from the Director General of the Ministry of Justice, but this is actually one of the rare occasions where it was incubated with broad support across the political spectrum, with members of the left-wing Meretz Party joining forces with members of the right-wing Jewish Home Party. And this kind of cooperation is probably the result of what's known to be a major problem of sex crime, trafficking, and abuse running rampant in urban sectors of Israel, particularly in Tel Aviv, where thousands of men and women are involved in the prostitution trade, sometimes very much against their wills. That's why the committee has also announced a new joint program to help rehabilitate those who have suffered neither the prostitution or the sex trade industries. New programs would also help former prostitutes find jobs, get proper health care, and seek treatment for sex abuse. Additional educational programs will also be placed in schools to teach about the harm that can come from the sex trade. While some argue that women should have a right to choose this line of work for themselves if they so wish, others point to the inherent corruption, abuse, and systemically linked crime rings through which prostitution runs. This kind of setting makes the possibility of exploitation and irreparable harm a very serious one. Over the last 10 years, sex crime cases have spiked by 22% in Israel. The new law, if passed, would punish those who solicit prostitutes with a roughly $400 fine, but that amount compounds for repeat offenders. Many are hopeful that these are the first steps towards ending a very dangerous trade.
In a massive deal for both diplomacy and economics, Egypt has just signed an agreement to begin importing Israeli gas starting next year. Though a lot of details still need to be worked out for this to go into full effect, Israeli leaders are already hailing this as a major stepping stone in Egypt-Israeli friendship, and Israeli gas CEOs say that this historic deal may be one of many more to come.
Egypt has quickly exploded into one of the world's fastest-growing importers of gas. Paralleled by Israel's exploration of the Leviathan gas field off the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, oil experts predict that there could be a billion-dollar industry just waiting to be pioneered here. As with all things in the oil industry, however, this isn't without its own share of controversy. The Leviathan field is believed to hold enough gas to power Israel for some 40 years, but the Israeli government has largely developed and earmarked this cachet strictly for foreign exports in deals where only oil tycoons seemingly come out on top. Additionally, the offshore drill site in Leviathan is within mere kilometers of some of Israel's most luxurious beach lines, igniting fears of environmental disaster and intense protests to protect Israel's beaches, marine life, and tourism economy. Regardless of the internal debate, a very real bottom line here in this Egyptian deal is the symbolic strengthening of diplomatic ties between Israel and Egypt. Israel's energy minister, Yuval Steinitz, echoing praises of Prime Minister Netanyahu, says that this deal is nothing short of the most significant export deal since the 1979 peace treaty with Egypt. The $15 billion contract would also potentially overrule an existing hiccup in Israeli-Egyptian trade, the collapse of a $2 billion gas export deal from Egypt in 2012. Terror insurgencies in the Sinai Peninsula disrupted the pipeline flow of that gas delivery to Israel, throwing a very real and a very expensive wrench into Israeli-Egyptian ties. Now, Egypt may merely turn this new Israeli import right around and sell it themselves, but clearly there's enough big money at stake here to build some very concrete bridges anyhow.
When we think about sustainability and green energy investments, problems with the cloud probably don't come to mind. But make no mistake here, roughly 10% of the world's energy consumption actually comes from internet servers and all that related infrastructure. Well, thankfully, a more environmentally friendly way to store our data is here, and it blows cloud technology right out of the sky. Here to tell us all about the Swarm is CEO and co-founder of Qubit, Stefano Onofri. Now, Stefano, what is the Swarm? Because it sounds very intriguing.
Thanks, Brett. So we have brought the cloud to the next level.
Okay.
Look, you, me, everybody that is watching us have one thing in common. We all pay for domestic Wi-Fi, but nobody's actually exploring that 100% because we go to work, we go to sleep. At the same time, though, we spend a lot of money in purchasing cloud services for ourselves or for our companies,
sure.
Which basically means we're paying somebody else to keep another connection turned on for us. So Qubit fixes all this waste because we're the first cloud provider that doesn't spend a single euro in building proprietary central polluting web farms, but we recycle and use the internet resources that we already have.
Wow.
So we transform these unused internet resources into encrypted web services, and in a nutshell, Qubit provides users with the first end-to-end encrypted and forever free cloud storage service.
Wow.
And to companies, we offer a superior cloud, much greener, 10 times greener, which have top cybersecurity, top quality, and because we have no infrastructure cost, just half the price.
So you're telling me that it's safer, more secure, more friendly for the environment, and also just way cheaper for everyone.
That's the original power of the internet. We make users communicate between each other, and so we can really leverage on the power of the internet.
Wow. How did you get to this? How did you come to this idea?
So I'm the CEO of a very brilliant team. My co-founders have a very strong tech background.
Right.
And we come from Italy, and from the very excellence of the engineering school in Italy, and that's where the software comes from.
Wow, amazing, man. This is great. Everyone deals with the cloud, right? So
yeah.
This is something that impacts not just business, but regular people individually. This is
everybody,
awesome work.
For ourselves and for our companies. Wow. So we're very happy to be here in Israel, where cybersecurity is a must. We're at the Techstars and Barclays Accelerator Program.
Cool.
And we're now active in 8 countries, but we're launching the Qubit officially worldwide by the end of the year.
Wow.
So right today, if you go on Qubit.io, as you could see on the video, you can leave the email to be the very first
to get first in line.
Yes.
Well, I have a feeling you're going to have a long list of people waiting in that line. Can't wait for the end of this year. Stefano, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brett.
Good
thank
luck.
You. Of course. See you.
Well, we've been following the chess career of little Liel Levitan for a while now. Now, Liel is only 7 years old, but she's already something of a chess legend after winning the European Championship a few months back. And that win meant that she would go on to compete at the World Chess Championship in Tunisia next year. But because Tunisia has often banned Israeli athletes from even entering the country in the past, many feared that this fate would befall little Liel as well. Well, we're pleased to announce that it looks like you can put those fears to rest. Take a look at this.
Following some intense international pressure, the Tunisian Chess Federation has confirmed that, yes, everyone will be allowed to compete at next year's chess championship with 0 exceptions. That, of course, means that the 99% Muslim-majority country of Tunisia will be welcoming Liel to the match as well. Something of a first in Tunisian-Israeli relations. A few weeks ago, Tunisia was actually stripped of its judo events for discriminating against Israeli athletes at competitions hosted in the country. Tunisia also banned 4 Israeli taekwondoers from a junior championship match back in April. Needless to say, both the talent and the adorableness of little Liel caught the whole world's attention this time. When it looked like Tunisia might have blocked Liel's entry visa, groups all over the world petitioned on her behalf under the campaign Let Liel Play. Many speculated that the World Chess Federation would even move the match out of Tunisia altogether if the child was banned. Thankfully, it looks like the tiny chess genius will get her shot at world glory come this April. Needless to say, an entire nation will be behind her.
Well, unfortunately, we're still quite a ways away from seeing Gal Gadot don the whip once again in Wonder Woman 2. But in the meantime, Israel's homegrown Hollywood megastar is circling a new role to play something of a real-life Wonder Woman, Jewish actress and inventor Hedy Lamarr. Now, in addition to being one of the biggest screen stars of the 30s and 40s, Lamarr's pioneering work in radio wave technology set the stage for all kinds of tech, including the very technology that would eventually become Bluetooth and Wi-Fi. That's true. Originally from Austria, Lamarr exploded onto the screen under the contract that she signed with MGM, playing in classic comedies, dramas, and romances for decades. But she is perhaps best known for her starring turn in Cecil B. DeMille's Samson and Delilah. Now, in her meantime, not that she had a lot of that, Lamarr liked to tinker with homemade inventions. Hollywood tycoon and notorious aviator Howard Hawks saw Lamarr's talent and assigned his own team of technicians to work at her disposal. They dated, by the way. When World War II erupted in Europe, Lamarr developed a revolutionary system that could guide Allied torpedoes and also jam the enemy's missiles at the same time. The system was actually adapted into the U.S. Navy in the 1960s, and it set the stage for what would eventually become the wireless signals that we use today all the time. All right, so with all that said, it's probably no wonder that Gal Gadot is eyeing this role. To top it off, the project is being helmed by the co-creator of the hit TV series The Affair, Sarah Treem. Coincidentally, or perhaps not, Treem created The Affair with Israeli filmmaker Haggai Levy. The same team also oversaw the adaptation of Levy's original Israeli series In Therapy for HBO. Right now, the Showtime Network has this project developed as a limited-run miniseries, so, who knows, maybe this time next year, Gadot will be campaigning for an Oscar for Wonder Woman 2 and an Emmy for this new series.
The Hebrew Word of the Day is brought to you by IDC Samru Ulpan, open to everyone.
Here comes our Hebrew Word of the Day. Israeli superstar Gal Gadot may star in a new series from the co-creator of The Affair, and there's a lot to love about that sentence I just said, and that's why today's word is roman, which means a love affair. Okay, so if the word roman, or love affair, sounds familiar, there's a good reason for that. A roman, in other languages, French for example, means a novel, and that's probably where the term romance novel comes from. But make no mistake here, in Hebrew, a roman can indeed refer to a behind-the-scenes love affair of the forbidden nature, something that the original creators of that show, Oman or the affair probably know all too well. Now let's go ahead and take a look at the weather forecast. Tonight will be partly cloudy and warm with a low of 80 or 26 degrees Celsius, and tomorrow you can expect partly cloudy skies and a slight rise in temperatures to a high of about 87 or 31 degrees Celsius.